Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by CyberTrust.
Hello and welcome to this, the 39th edition of Risky Business. On this week's podcast, we'll be hearing all about the Tor network. It's built as an anonymizer, a way for internet users to connect to websites without the operators of those websites knowing who's visiting. Basically, it blocks your IP. Think of it as caller ID blocking for your internet connection. Well, there was a huge controversy a couple of months ago when a Swedish hacker, Dan Egerstad, set up a rogue Tor exit node. Now, that's where data passes from the encrypted part of the Tor network to the outside world in clear text. And he examined the information that came through this exit node. Now, he wound up intercepting the emails and mail passwords of government, embassy, NGO and corporate staffers. Initially, we all thought that Dan was able to do this because the organisations were using Tor in a silly way, thinking that it was encrypting all of their traffic. But as we'll find out, Dan now says the passwords he intercepted were actually being used by hackers who'd already compromised the mail accounts. The bad guys were using Tor to mask their attacks. We'll also hear from veteran IT security consultant Sam Stover on the same topic, and we'll be chatting again to Verizon Business Security Solutions data breach investigator Andrew Valentine about the Salesforce.com hack. If you haven't heard about it, stay tuned. Some quick housekeeping matters now. This podcast is endorsed by the Australian Information Security Association, or AISA, and they have some events coming up. There's a members-only seminar day and AGM taking place on the 30th of November in Sydney at the Commonwealth Bank. In Brisbane, AISA will host a computer security day in conjunction with AusCert, and in Melbourne, there will be a branch meeting. See aisa.org.au for more information. Now, I have to tell you all, too, that I'm taking a week off from today. I am travelling to the KiwiCon Hacker Conference in New Zealand to record audio for upcoming shows and write a couple of stories. So it won't really be practical for me to get a podcast together for next Tuesday. Sorry about that, but you know we'll be back with some top-quality interviews once we're done in the land of the long white cloud. Now, normally at this point in the podcast, we'd chat to Munir Katadia about the last week's headlines. Sadly, Munir had to rush to London a few days ago to attend to a family emergency. So, Munir, if you're tuning in, I'm sure I speak for all Risky Business listeners when I say I hope it's going okay over there, and we'll look forward to your return. In the meantime, I'm flying solo with this week's news headlines provided by zdnet.com.au. And remember, you can read all of these stories there. In the first news item, the US Congress has blasted Yahoo over its involvement in assisting the Chinese government in tracking down dissidents there. Yahoo's CEO, Jerry Yang, and Executive Vice President Michael Callahan faced a House Committee on Foreign Affairs hearing in Washington yesterday over providing misleading information to Congress last year as part of an investigation into the company's role in disclosing former journalist and cyber dissident Shi Tao's identity to Chinese authorities. Shi Tao was arrested in November 2004 after sending a government internal document delivered to his publication to several foreign websites. The document was issued as a warning to journalists of possible social destabilization and risks posed by returning dissidents on the eve of the 15th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, and requested that they not report on the occasion. Good one, Yahoo, and again I think I'm speaking for all Risky Business listeners when I say I hope Yahoo falls on something sharp, like a profit downgrade or a massive fine or scandal. In other news, SAP is working with the Queensland University of Technology on software to hunt down fraudulent employee behaviour. The new software will have the capacity to detect fraud in real time by analysing user behaviour for activities that might indicate fraudulent behaviour, such as the creation of a fake supplier or employee in order to divert company funds. As we mentioned in the intro, Salesforce.com has revealed few details about a security breach caused by a phishing attack against an employee that surrendered internal customer database details. Details of Salesforce.com's customers were stolen as a result of the password being surrendered, the CRM services company admitted to customers on Monday. Salesforce.com first noticed a possible security breach when it saw a rise in phishing attacks directed against customers. One of its employees had been tricked into disclosing a password, allowing a customer list to be stolen. Big whoops there. I'm sure there are a few software as a service companies out there who really don't appreciate this news. To Mac news now, and if you thought the Mac-targeted Trojan discovered last week was a one-off, you'll need to think again, ZDNet Australia reports. Security firm F-Secure has discovered 32 variants of the thing in the wild, but say claims about its powers have been wildly overstated. That piece quotes Mikko Hyppönen from F-Secure as saying the gang behind it seems serious about targeting Mac users as well as Windows users, and they'll keep putting out slightly modified versions of the Trojan for the Mac. It seems the easy ride for Mac users is over, bugger. Still, the antivirus companies will be thrilled. They just grew their market by 3%. To all things Russian now, and an alleged Russian malware hosting gang has abruptly disappeared, according to software maker Trend Micro. The Russian business network, which was allegedly heavily involved in hosting malware packing kits, suddenly dropped off the internet on Tuesday. Researchers from VeriSign said the Russian business network had been able to offer bulletproof hosting for malware by means of links to the Russian government. Raymond Jeans, chief executive officer for Trend Micro's antivirus division, claimed it is likely that whatever protection the business network enjoyed was withdrawn because the group had overreached itself. Recently, they've become too greedy, Jeans said. And finally, a US botmaster faces up to 60 years in prison and fines of up to $1.75 million after admitting to infecting at least 250,000 PCs with information-stealing malware. By day, 26-year-old John Kenneth Schiffer worked as a security consultant for the company 3G Communications. By night, he operated a 250,000-strong PC botnet, which US federal prosecutors are claiming he used to steal information and money from the users of eBay's online banking service PayPal. The malicious software developed by Schiffer accessed the Windows system feature Protected Store, which encrypts and stores password for online accounts. Well, that's it for this week's news, and it's time to turn to this week's feature interviews. In August, Swedish hacker Dan Egerstad gained access to 1,000 sensitive embassy, NGO, and corporate email accounts. He'd later post 100 of those online, drawing fire from the IT security community. But the question on everybody's lips was, how did he do it? Risky Business at the time predicted that he'd set up a rogue Tor access node, and we were right. Now, Tor was originally developed by the US Navy to allow its personnel to conceal their location from websites and online services they'd access while posted overseas. It's now maintained and distributed by a registered charity as an open source tool that anyone can freely download and install. Hundreds of thousands of internet users have installed Tor, which works by connecting its users' requests randomly to volunteer-run Tor network nodes. They sort of bounce their connection through a bunch of different systems. Now, it's all encrypted from the time that it leaves the user's computer, goes through the Tor network, and then passes out. And it's when it passes out of that part of the network that it bounces back to clear text. So Egerstad set up a Tor exit node where the data carried by the network can be intercepted in clear text, and he analyzed it. And that's how he got his grubby little Swedish mitts all over that sensitive data. Then, as we know, he posted the information on his website in a highly controversial move. At the time, we all thought he'd grabbed these passwords from idiotic embassy staffers who thought Tor was an end-to-end encryption system. But now Egerstad thinks he captured those passwords from hackers who were using Tor to access already compromised accounts without giving up their location. I spoke to Egerstad by phone from Sweden.
I did it because I had to do some research on how many people are actually encrypting their emails, and I thought, well, Tor is pretty much used all over the world, so it's going to be easy to get some statistics and some numbers on how many people are encrypting their emails. And I was doing this research for a couple of days, and right before I was shutting it down, I by accident just saw a government email. So that kind of got my attention and got my idea to, well, let's put up more nodes and do this for a longer time and see what's happened.
What did happen?
Well, I did set up 5 nodes all over the world, pretty much. And what happened was that I put in a regular packet sniffer and sorted out for words like government, gov, and certain domain names, military, war, terrorist, and all kinds of words which I thought, well, NSA probably will use, and I'm going to use the same one. And it started pretty much just flowing in mails from all over the world, not only these 100 accounts, but around 250, perhaps 300 different email accounts belonging to governments.
Now, anyone can set up a Tor node, can't they?
Yes, anyone can. And it only takes, you don't have to know anything at all. You just download a software off the internet and you're done.
Okay, so it's just something you run on a typical home PC.
Yeah, I ran it on Linux servers, of course, but you can run it on Windows as well and your home computer. It doesn't really matter.
Now, were you surprised by what started flowing through those boxes when you started filtering for those keywords?
Yes, I was. And at first I thought, well, these accounts are probably not very sensitive, but then I started reading some of the emails, and some of this was really sensitive, actually, and I just stood there for like 2 months before I knew what to do with it. Did try to contact a few, but didn't really get any good response, and you never do when you do contact people, so. But I was trying to figure out what I'm going to do with it, my legal actions on it, and I just ended up with, well, screw it, I'm just going to post it online and see what happens.
Yeah, well, I suppose, was it a case of you being put in an untenable position? Because if you had have handed over that information to the Swedish authorities, you would have really been engaged in assisting them with their espionage.
Yeah, exactly. It was impossible to give it to Swedish authorities because, well, it really would be espionage. Even if they wouldn't use it, it would still be, it would putting Sweden in a bad situation as well, because if Sweden, the Swedish government or Swedish security police would call some other country telling, well, we got access to your emails. That's not going to sound very good. And
no.
I didn't want to put anyone in that kind of trouble.
Okay.
So I thought, I'm just going to take the hit myself.
What would you just say to people who criticized you for putting those logins and passwords for sensitive email accounts onto the internet for anyone to use?
Yeah, I can understand their point of view. I had the same one, and I did think through it very, very carefully for quite some time. However, most of this criticism came before I told them what I did. Most people thought I hacked something and I broke in somewhere and it was some kind of new exploit and I should have contacted the vendor. The problem is there is no vendor. The people who are behind Tor, they're posting this information publicly saying that don't do this. This is dangerous. And it's in the documentation and so on and so on. And when that came out, that I actually just used something that's very well known, people stopped criticizing and changed their mind, pretty much, most people at least.
Why do you think it is that embassies were using this system in an insecure way?
That's also a whole point of the story which has been forgotten. I hadn't said much about it, but many of these accounts have already been compromised. The logins I caught were actually not legit users, but actual hackers have been reading these accounts for several times. Some were using eTor, some were not. I know, for example, in India, many of these accounts have been compromised, so there was actually compromised passwords I caught, and many of the accounts were using Tor even if they shouldn't be using it. They were breaking their own rules.
So you say these were compromised accounts. How did you know they were compromised accounts?
I know that now. That was pretty much my feeling that they would be, a lot of them at least. And I've been getting some information later on after I published it and said that, well, okay, it was actually pretty good you did that because we noticed that we had a break-in a long time ago. The hacker was actually just using Tor to access it.
Okay, so Do you think that intelligence services around the world have been setting up Tor nodes to conduct signals intelligence to intercept data?
I don't know, and I don't like to speculate about it, but I'm telling that people that it's possible, and that if you actually look into where these Tor nodes are hosted and how big they are, some of these nodes cost like thousands of dollars each month just to host because they're using lots of bandwidth, they're heavy-duty servers, and so on. Who would pay for this and be anonymous? It's, for example, there's 5 or 6 in Washington, D.C., which are really, really major servers. We're hosting around 40 to 50 terabyte each.
Yeah. So there's some money going into that, you think?
You don't need to be paranoid, but still, you need to know what you're doing.
And what do you think about the Tor network in general? Do you think that it is a useful thing?
Yes, it very much is. It's a good thing, and I have really good contact with the Tor developers. However, it's not a security tool. It's a privacy tool. The problem is that if you actually analyze the traffic, most of the traffic is just porn. So it's kind of sad it's being used for just that.
That's the internet in general, isn't it, though, Dan?
True, but why do you need to hide yourself if you're looking at porn? I don't get it.
So I want to ask you too, like human rights activists and people who need to conceal their identities, also journalists operating in oppressive regimes, use Tor. Do you think it has an important role to play in human rights and about spreading information without the risk of oppressive regimes finding out people are looking at subversive material?
Yeah, information needs to be free, and you need to get your word out and have non-objective information out there. So Tor is an excellent tool for doing that, but you still need to encrypt it, because if you don't, maybe they can't see who you are, but they can still see that you are sending this information. You can read your emails or your articles or whatever you're doing. Okay. And, of course, your passwords if you're logging into it as well. People think they're protected just because they use Tor. Not only they think it's encrypted, but they also think that nobody can find me. However, if you're, like, if you configured your computer wrong, which probably more than 50% of the people using Tor has, you can still find the person behind the other side.
And how do you do that?
Yeah. Well, if you use JavaScript and cookies and so on, you can still find out who is actually their real IP. It's not that hard. Like I said, if you're not very, if you haven't configured your computer or your browser correct, you can still be traced.
I interviewed the people who maintain Tor. They said that they actually publish guidelines on their website, and if people follow these guidelines, they're okay. Do you think that's the case, or do you think the problem is people don't generally follow guidelines?
People don't read rules or manuals ever. On the Tor website, it says pretty big and at several places that Tor is not encrypting your traffic. It's just hiding who you are. But still people are like, whoa, it's hiding who I am. Well, then it's probably a security thing. It's encrypted and so on and so on. The Tor team is great. They've been doing some great work, and it works great. Tor really works great for its purpose. And if you don't follow the rules, well, nothing's going to like protect you if you don't follow the rules. It's like if you have the best firewall in the world, but you're not locking the door, people can just walk in and take the computer. You need to cover all aspects of it.
I believe when you notified embassies, the only one you got a response from was Iran.
Yes, exactly. They called me, first the Swedish embassy, and talked to me for a moment. And then I don't know who I was talking to, but they hooked me up with someone in Iran who was in charge of security. And they wanted to know everything I knew and so on and so on.
And you thought they were quite responsive?
Yeah, that's the only response I got. Except from a couple of calls from the Swedish security police. But that was pretty much all the response I got from any authority.
And you haven't been, you haven't had any blowback really from this, have you?
No. I know that I've been, they reported me to police in Hong Kong for some reason, but they reported me for breaking in, which I haven't done, so it's kind of, I think it's kind of funny that if they can prove me breaking in anywhere, fine. That would be awesome if they could prove that.
So you're not worried about applying for visas for countries now?
Actually, a couple of weeks ago, I went to the U.S., and right before I went, the Swedish security police called me up and said, like, you probably shouldn't go to the U.S. because the laws there are a little bit different. We can't guarantee your safety.
Mm.
But I still went, and no problem at all. So I deleted everything I had because the information I had was not belonging to... It was belonging to so many different countries that no one... single person should have this information. So I actually deleted it, and the hard drives are long gone.
Okay. Dan Egerstad, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Dan Egerstad on the line from Sweden. Keen to explore this issue a little deeper, I put out the feelers to see who else in the InfoSec community had played around with Tor. Veteran IT security consultant Stan Stover, he worked with network security wizards on Dragon IDS before it was bought and made useless by InterAssist Networks, remember that? Well, Sam uses Tor for a few things, and he was happy to share his insights with Risky Business listeners during this phone interview from the US. Sam says he uses Tor when he wants to mask his identity when he's going browsing somewhere where he doesn't want the owner of the server to know where he's coming from.
I mean, there's a couple of problems with Tor, namely, you know, there's this false sense of security with Tor in that, you know, you believe that your traffic is encrypted while it's inside the Tor network, which is true. However, the last hop, you know, out of the Tor network and to your destination is clear text, unless you're doing HTTPS. And I just know from watching other people who run Tor onion routers, that complain that the majority of the people who are, you know, using their Tor network are cruising porn. That kind of alerted my curiosity. I'm like, how do they know that? So I started digging a little bit deeper, and I found that that last mile, as it were, is unencrypted, and people can easily sniff your traffic and, you know, catch your passwords or whatever, depending on, you know, what's encrypted and what's not. So, you know, once I kind of figured that out, I realized that if I, you know, I would not use or recommend Tor as a tool to hide from people between you and your endpoint. It's really purely a tool to hide from the endpoint.
Okay.
So, I think it's a tool. I don't think it's a silver bullet. So I use it when that particular application suits my needs, but I definitely don't view it as a complete anonymization tool that I think the public perception is, you know, has of it.
Okay. And there are problems too with using ActiveX and JavaScript, aren't there?
Yes, there are. In fact, I've heard of a proof of concept where you could browse to a malicious website, and that website could execute JavaScript. I don't think I've ever seen ActiveX, although I've heard of that as well, where they can actually pull out your external IP address. And again, I never got a chance to see this actually executed. I think I heard rumors about it at Black Hat just this past in July, where, you know, people were claiming that they could execute code that would reveal, you know, basically set up a session with your home box and be able to see your external IP address. And, you know, my question was, okay, well, are they going to see my internal IP address, my 192.168. whatever I'm using inside? Mm. Are they actually going to see, you know, my DSL modem or my cable modem IP address, my legal IP address to the outside world? And the response that I got was, they'll see your outside routable IP address and not, you know, an inside RFC 1918 address that, you know, doesn't help anybody.
Most people wouldn't really think to disable JavaScript and ActiveX when they're using Tor, would they?
It's all a matter of, you know, who is using it and what are they using it for. You know, like, I use Firefox with NoScript. I believe that at least on the JavaScript side, that protects me from those kind of things. But I've also heard that there's pure HTML code out there that can accomplish the same feat, although, again, I haven't seen it. So, you know, yeah, if I'm doing some kind of something where I really need to remain anonymous, Tor is definitely not the way to go. And I think if you know, anybody Googling on, you know, Tor and defeating it, or, you know, problems with Tor, hacking Tor, you know, it is going to find that there are definitely some things out there that should lead you to believe that it's not as much of a silver bullet as it's being touted.
So, but I mean, as you said, I mean, mostly it's just being used by people who want to browse weird porn.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's definitely what I'm hearing, at least, you know, from people posting on, you know, different news groups, you know, networking news groups, where they kind of complain that it's, you know, I go through all this effort, I share my bandwidth, and all people want to do is cruise porn and hide it from their employer. And, you know, if that's your goal, you know, this probably works fine, you know, because between, you know, where you're sitting and what your employer can see, you're probably safe. You know, you're probably encrypted. It's that last, you know, the last mile, as I'm kind of calling it, that last, from the last hop out of the onion cloud to your destination, that's where everything, you know, kind of comes into the clear or becomes, you know, accessible, either to the endpoint if they've got the malicious JavaScript, or to, you know, the guy running the outer layer of the onion. You know, if you don't care about those kind of people, then, you know, hey, Tor is the way to go for you.
And you actually have set up, much like Dan Egerstad did, you've actually set up your own Tor network before, have you? Your own Tor exit node, and had a bit of a peek at what's coming through?
I did test that out once. It's pretty easy. I'm a Mac user, and if you download the Vidalia package, it's pretty easy. As long as you, you know, have your firewall rules set right, it's pretty easy to become a part of that, you know, an exit node. And yes, I set it up once real quick just to make sure that, you know, I could see other people's traffic. And sure enough, you can. And I was like, okay, I'm not, I'm not interested in that kind of intelligence gathering or anything like that. So I didn't pursue it because it just uses up bandwidth. But it helped me realize, you know, what are the limitations of this tool. You know, it's a hammer, just like anything else. I can pound nails, but I can't screw in screws with it. And
yeah.
I think as long as people understand what those limitations of that tool are, then you use it for when it's necessary, and you don't when you don't.
And I suppose I want to ask you what you think of what Dan Egerstad did with those embassy passwords and whatnot.
Well, I mean, when you're talking about full disclosure, I mean, I don't know. I don't. That's definitely a tough scenario because it definitely had an impact in that people all of a sudden now took notice of, oh, maybe Tor isn't the silver bullet that we thought it was. However, I'm not sure that I condone the mechanism by which, you know, what kind of information had to be exposed in order to do that. But I don't know. You get into this weird moral, ethical debate as to, you know, what degree of full disclosure is the proper degree. And, you know, it's a religious debate that you can, you know, take up with just about anybody. So, you know, had I seen that, would have I done it? No. But, you know, again, you run into the loophole where if people aren't made aware of the, you know, limitations of a particular piece of technology and they use it improperly, there are ramifications for it.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose what you're saying here is that Tor is useful, but you've got to kind of know what you're doing, and most people don't really know what they're doing, so it's kind of leading to a false sense of security.
I think it does provide, well, it provides a false sense of anonymity and security, I guess, kind of along with that. People hear encryption, and they automatically assume that everything they do is, you know, I'm behind a bulletproof shield, and that's not the case with Tor. I mean, it's not. I mean, there's some sophisticated, cool JavaScript stuff that, you know, really kind of digs deep into how Tor works. And then you just have the simple fact that, you know, the exit node can sniff your traffic. I mean,
but it won't give you the return path. It won't give you the IP unless, I mean, there's got to be something in the content that gives up your...
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, that's definitely true. You're not, you know, the exit node sniffing does not give you, you know, the IP address. You're not vulnerable to attack. So there's different degrees of information leakage that go on, you know, depending on who's doing what against you. So you're definitely right. But, you know, if you pass a username and password in the clear to a particular website, they know where the endpoint is, and they can go back, they can go log in and, you know, hijack your account. You run into issues where it's got to be clear text in order for them to sniff it, but... So.
Like POP3. And I mean, you know, I find that in entirely credible scenario that intelligence services around the world are monitoring the Tor network, because really it's very easy to monitor and it carries traffic which people, you know, by its very definition, it carries traffic that people don't want intercepted. So it seems to me a logical place to do some interceptions.
I would not disagree with that statement.
So you think it's possible?
I think that would make, I mean, imagine you're some Russian company and you want to harvest American credentials. I mean, your ability to connect and become an exit node to the Tor network is trivial. The amount of effort, all you need is bandwidth in a box.
Mm.
So, sure. I mean, domestic or international, you know, if you want to do intelligence gathering, there's definitely data to be had there. Definitely. And it's so easy. And, you know, the whole anonymity of becoming part of it makes it very easy. I mean, you don't know who, you know, what bounces your traffic's going through to get from point A to point B. I mean, that's part of the way the Tor network was designed. So, you know, yeah, you have no idea if, you know, some guy in China is watching all your traffic, or if it's some guy in Germany or a guy in Illinois. You don't know.
Sam Stover, thank you for speaking with us this week.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for the call.
That was Sam Stover on the line from the USA there, rounding out this week's discussion on Tor. Coming up next is our sponsor interview. Verizon Business Security Solutions pays our bills, so each week we have one of their consultants on the show to chew the fat. This week it's Andrew Valentine again. He's one of those data forensics types who investigates cybercrime at the front line. And we decided to speak to him about this Salesforce.com shenanigan. Now, Washington Post security blogger Brian Krebs wrote a good post on this. In it, he said Salesforce.com had acknowledged that a recent spate of targeted email virus and phishing attacks against its customers resulted from one of its own employees falling for a phishing scam and turning over the keys to the company's customer database. On October 19, US payroll giant Automatic Data Processing and several banks were among a number of institutions that were victimized by a series of highly targeted phishing scams that addressed recipients by name and asked them to click on a link, which of course tried to download password-stealing malicious software. A bank executive alleged that the scammers obtained their list of their customers via a data compromise at Salesforce.com, and that's where the plot thickened. Salesforce.com data was also implicated in a pair of targeted malware attacks that appeared to have been sent from the Federal Trade Commission, an attack that installed password-stealing software on PCs of more than 500 victims. Salesforce.com is finally owning up to a data loss. The company wrote to customers with a mea culpa, saying that it had learned that Salesforce.com employees had been the victim of phishing scams that allowed a Salesforce.com customer contact list to be copied. As a result of this, they wrote, a small number of our customers began receiving bogus emails that looked like Salesforce.com invoices, but were not. They were also phishers. Unfortunately, a very small number of our customers who were contacted had end users that revealed their passwords to the phisher. Whoops. And that's bad news for software as a service providers. Valentine joined me by phone from the USA to share his thoughts. Andrew, Salesforce.com, security has always been a real selling point for them, that they're, you know, very, very careful with their customers' data, and obviously a lot of that data is sensitive. Do you think that incidents like this have the potential to seriously damage the hosted application or software as a service landscape?
No, I think the I think the potential within that market is just too great, you know, for a hacking incident. You know, with any growing marketplace, there's going to be stumbling blocks going forward. But I think the way that Salesforce is moving forward, that, as you said, disclosing, they're doing exactly the right thing to position themselves to be, you know, in step in the future. It's always better if a company discloses rather than if they don't, but the information about a data compromise leaks to the media. They're doing the exact right thing that they should be.
Well, they're kind of between a rock and a hard place in this instance, because I'm sure if their customers had been using, you know, in-house CRM and there had been a hack, they wouldn't really feel the same pressure to disclose that information you know, to the world and shout it from the rooftops like Salesforce has been forced to do in this instance.
I wouldn't know if Salesforce has been necessarily forced to do it. You might know more information than me, but certainly the information that I've read makes me think that they, you know, as proactively as possible disclosed knowing that there was a bad situation going on. And I think that's what any merchant or service provider that suffers a data compromise should do.
And yeah, this was actually a spear phishing type of attack, which was really targeted malware towards Salesforce.com employees. So it looks like, you know, these spear phishing things that have often been hyped as, you know, this is a really good example of that actually being successful, isn't it?
It is a good example of that. And Patrick, it's actually a little bit more. It goes beyond just being spear phishing, which is a directed attack. So, I mean, you know, I'll get phishing emails. Anybody will get phishing emails that appear to come from a bank that I don't even do business with. So if you get a phishing scam that's directed at you because a bad guy has determined that you belong to a specific bank and they've determined your email address, of course that's a lot stronger and it's a lot more compelling to a potential victim of phishing or of identity fraud that that's legitimate email. But the Salesforce thing goes just a little bit further in that there is already out there a lot of awareness around phishing scams against, you know, private accounts, private banking accounts, private business, your personal business rather. But when you get a spear phishing directed attack that's related to your business or to your career, that adds just another degree of legitimacy to that attempt at identity fraud that I think would fool a whole lot of people that are otherwise pretty aware of the issue. So that that speaks to a lot. You know, within your work email box. You don't expect to see it there.
I think one of the things that these guys actually did once they'd taken over the Salesforce, you know, taken some of the Salesforce data, was to email Salesforce.com customers with fake invoices from Salesforce.com, which, of course, you know, they're much more likely to think were legitimate.
Exactly, and I hate to admit it. If I had a directed spear phishing attack that had a work-related invoice pointed at me, you know, I would have to second guess myself to determine whether or not I was legitimate. And that's exactly what the bad guys are trying to do, and they're succeeding.
So it's really hard. I mean, we're dealing with serious problems here involving trust online, aren't we? When you can't even trust the invoice coming from your vendor, whether it really is that invoice. I mean, what can we do to prevent these sort of attacks?
Absolutely. It's a question of awareness. If you have any sort of question at all about whether or not a particular invoice is legitimate, it's something that you should contact. Don't let your vendor contact you, but contact your vendor directly and ask them, did you send me an invoice?
But then, if we have to make a phone call to verify every email we get, we're kind of, we've got some productivity problems there, don't we?
Yes, we do have some productivity problems, but I believe these are growing pains. And, once people realize that the spear phishing phenomenon is not going to be limited to your private life, but will step into your business or career life as well, I think the awareness level of, the general populace will be raised there too. People are going to get smarter. As the bad guys get smarter, the people are going to get smarter too.
And of course, we need to make our software more secure so that opening an invoice won't be something that'll get you owned.
Absolutely. I would like to think that when this is all said and done, that we're going to be in a situation where hopefully filters will prevent those invoices from even reaching your inbox. But that's maybe that's just wishful thinking on my part.
Yeah, well, there's always the zero-day factor. I mean, this has been a problem that we've been facing for a number of years now, and there doesn't seem to be any solution.
Sure, and that's a great point you brought up about using stuff like this to install malware. That's great. I mean, you could, as a bad guy, send somebody a directed spear phishing attack related to their business, and man, that looked like something that's fairly legitimate and safe to open, and you'll find that it's infected with some sort of Trojan horse malware. That's certainly a doomsday scenario to think about. That's certainly scary. The answer here is to build awareness, around the issue.
I've just had an idea. I think perhaps you and me, we should go into business. We can join the dark side. It seems pretty easy at the moment. What do you think?
I would never join the dark side, although I do envy how much more money they make than I do.
Come on, 50-50.
I can't do it.
Okay, well, if you change your mind, you'll have to let me know. Andrew Valentine, thank you very much for joining us again this week.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of Risky Business. Our thanks again to our sponsor, Verizon Business Security Solutions, and our hosting partner, Vigabyte. They do VMware-based virtual hosting. Very cool stuff. They also give us radically subsidized hosting, so I would say that, wouldn't I? Well, until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thank you for listening.